who were pretty happy with paper and didn't see the reason to use these fancy new things. It's in that context of a couple years of working through a number of different innovations, building some history of sharing, learning, finding out who can do local testing and then sharing with others, that we introduced the advanced clinic access key changes. There were other things, a history of clinical performance measurement, fairly robust. One of the key features of the specific change of improving appointment access included moving to not an appointment management process, to panel management, but helping providers understand their work as not just managing the patients on their appointment schedule, but managing a panel of patients. And each provider, physician or nurse practitioner, was assigned a panel of patients. For physicians, it was about 1,200, and nurse practitioners, it was less. And if they managed them well and took care of them and did good clinical care and good satisfaction, that if their appointment books were open, they would not be penalized. So panel management was a key ancillary aid to our spread of the ACA key changes. I'm going to move to page 24. So in terms of, I think I mentioned some of this, some previous collaboratives, there was a national collaborative we participated on, some of the other things we did to promote awareness, some of the national work. Initially in 2001, we had a regional collaborative around advanced clinic access, and then in 2002, we did facility-specific collaboratives that drove it down and organized not just a few people from each medical center or clinic, but basically every primary care team in every medical center had the opportunity to participate in a collaborative, learning collaborative, with learning sessions and action periods. And that helped to drive awareness, to spread the awareness throughout our system. There was other technical information, and you can see it here, the seminars and monographs and other tools we use, a spread assessment matrix, to see how rapidly or how extensively we were spreading the ideas. So both awareness in terms of making we had a communication resource guide, building awareness, and also some technical information were parts of our effort to spread these advanced clinic access key changes. Perhaps we could pause here for a moment, and if the audience is willing to think about how you might reflect on the relative importance of awareness versus technical information in your spread challenge. And if people were willing, Kurt, to give us a little bit of feedback of how they assess the importance of awareness and technical information, perhaps we could take a few comments from the audience at this time.
Okay, and again, we're doing that the same way. All you have to do is press 1 on the keypad, and that'll put you into the queue. And at this point, I don't have anyone who is in the queue.
Let me just give it a minute.
Sure.
And if there's input, that would be helpful. And if not, we'll move on.
Okay. Still seeing no responses. That's been about 15 or 20 seconds. Oh, quick, at the last minute. To San Diego, to Janet's location. The line is open. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Tina Daly from San Diego.
Could you speak up, please? We can just barely hear you.
Yes. I'm interested in knowing specifics about how you attempted to reduce the no-show rate. I heard you say tickler file for future appointments. That seems like a fairly complex system to implement with multiple people involved. First of all, you'd need a computer program. They would need to be printed out somewhere. Someone would have to manage that, so a person would have to be assigned to do that. And monies would have to be allocated for the postcards. The postcards would need to be confidential, so they'd have to be the perforated type of reminder card. And then how did you determine what was said on the card, and did it decrease the no-show rate as an independent variable? I'm also interested in other types of systems that you use to attempt to reduce no-show rate, because we have a problem with that here. And when someone no-shows, then it actually takes two appointments, the appointment that they would have had and the appointment that they thus take when they reschedule. So it does decrease the wait time for other veterans waiting for their appointments, or increase the wait time. Would you comment on those questions, please?
Jim, this is Marie. If you wouldn't mind if I interrupted. I would just like to suggest, and if it's all right with the caller and if it's all right with Jim, then maybe we hold that question for the general questions at the end, since it is a fairly specific question about the, you know, the particular changes that Jim was talking about. But if we could maybe keep this part of the discussion focused on the, you know, on the spread aspects, and then come back to that more specific question at the end if we have time.
And if not, Marie, I would be glad to follow up with, I believe it's Judy in San Diego, on the web conversation and provide additional details that might not even be able to handle in this call.
That would be terrific. Judy, is that okay with you?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
And thanks to San Diego. We have Lake Success, New York, at Claire's location as the next one for comments. And go ahead, please.
This is Richard. I'm involved in the physician's office project regarding mammography rates, immunization rates, diabetes testing, things like that. There's about 20,000 primary care physicians in New York State, and I'm looking at the importance of awareness and technical information. I'm relatively new to the organization, and I'm actually quite impressed with the amount of technical information that is available regarding the quality measures in all these areas, both on the web in the form of brochures, in the form of action groups and coalitions, and there seems to be no end of technical information. But as I get into the physician's offices that I'm now visiting, I find that that information, the awareness of all those things by physician office staff and the physician itself seems to be the more important factor. And just in terms of assessing the importance of awareness and technical information, I see there's plenty of technical information, seems to be all good stuff. But the awareness factor in physicians' offices about what they need to do within their practices to use and utilize all of this information seems to be the more important one to me.
I think that's an excellent point. And, Tom, you might pick up on that because it relates to the issue of time and attention are the scarcest resources, mm-hmm. and also other notions of building awareness. And I think the caller makes an excellent point about, you know, we can get buried in technical information. So we tried to focus it a bit. It was still a lot at times, but we tried to hone it down to the most useful information. And I think a key channel of building awareness for us was these local collaboratives, where we've got people together. They would share their reality, talk to each other, and then say, hey, you sounds like you've got something that might be useful for me. Maybe I'll go out and try it. So the local collaboratives was of getting people together face-to-face was a very helpful way to build awareness, in addition to all the other modalities, videos and emails and other measurement stuff we shared with people.
Just a quick point on this one. I think we often do ourselves a disservice by having materials that are overly complete, so that if one produces a draft, or if you have if you mark confidential and leave it on the Xerox machine, it'll fly around an organization much faster than if it's printed or put into a closed video form, where people don't feel they need to put something of themselves into it in order to kind of complete it. Or this is Don Berwick's notion of really feeling that they're reinventing it in their own setting. And I think it links to the San Diego comment, because when you do peel back the onion, there are all these incredibly locally complicated issues that involve many more people than just the person who gets to go to the Breakthrough Collaborative or even the mini team. And they've really got to get that group actively pulling from this vast amount of information that is increasingly available but underused.
And I think a key feature we found is that the local team structure was very important, how people talk with each other locally. And some of the sites that were the most rapidly adopting of some of these changes had the most well-developed team structure. They met regularly. There was a culture of collaboration and communication. They would talk with each other and meet regularly. Other sites, they would never meet. They were practicing alone together. They would come to work. They would see their patients sort of pass each other in the hall or interact around a specific patient, but then go home and not really talk about how they were doing their work. And we, at least local here in my Bedford site, we had to create, you will have a team meeting, you will make, we will authorize time during the week to get together and review your wait time, the changes you want to test, and that sort of thing. So we empowered and authorized those kinds of local activities, and I think the collaboratives were a context to make that happen also. So that was helpful. I'm going to just take a few more minutes and finish up. I'm going to talk on page 25. A little bit in contrast to primary care, eye care in Vizen 1, it's a different service. There's only 13 sites of care, many fewer patients, only 100 staff. And you can see some of the features there. The eye care on the bottom of page 25 had never been convened as a clinical service. So these were optometrists and ophthalmologists in the various medical centers and some ancillary sites in New England who had been sort of toiling away in their clinics, doing the best they can, often organized as a part of a department of surgery, but as sort of a smallish division in larger departments of surgery. And the wait times in eye care were the worst of all of our performance clinics, around 70 to 80 day wait for a next available appointment. And nationally, that was also the case. So there was tremendous impetus from on high to try to improve this. And what we did is we convened them together in a collaborative, and we brought together the eye clinicians, the optometrists and ophthalmologists together into an eye care collaborative. And we asked them to do some pre-work. We taught them and helped them to do a little bit of understanding their capacity, how many FTEs and appointment slots would you have every day. We gave them an exercise to over a two-week period to measure demand, and we organized, gave them data, which they probably often they had never seen before, about their wait times. We organized that pre-work, and then fairly typically in a learning collaborative, we taught them some of the ACA changes and the Plan, Do, Study, Act rapid improvement methods and helped them develop a plan for testing changes. And out of that initial meeting, there was just tremendous excitement, partly a feeling of gratitude among the clinicians that somebody was paying attention to their issues. Nobody had ever asked them to come together before, and they found that just connecting with other like-minded clinicians from across the region was tremendously validating and supportive. They found out that people shared their clinical interests, their commitment to patients, but also some of the hassles and problems that they were struggling with day to day. And the way we framed this is we wanted to improve access to care and improve clinic services in eye care. So on top of page 26, we then used some of the typical, again, seemingly typical learning collaborative methods, monthly conference calls, the periodic face-to-face meetings, sharing successes and problems. But then as we worked on the advanced clinic access issues, trying to make changes to improve access, the group started bringing up other issues. For example, there was unevenness of need for capital equipment, for eye slit lamps and eye lanes and some other visual field machines, other machines needed in the eye care process. And typically in the past, this had been done on a medical center by medical center basis. Every eye clinic would try to speak to their director or their local team to say, we need some capital equipment. And we said we would be more powerful if we organized our capital budgeting on a regional basis by the Vizen, so that that eye clinic with the highest need, we all said, VA Connecticut is the one with the highest need, they should get the first dollar of capital budget dollars expended on eye care in the region, and then Tagus, Maine is the second most. So we tried to prioritize as a region, and we collected information about our capital equipment and our resources and then tried to prioritize that together. Now what's evolving in eye care, given that now they're interested in looking at some of their clinical care patterns. How do we care for glaucoma? What is our rate of screening for retinal disease and diabetics? So from this waits and delays focus, this group is now beginning to say we are a clinical group, a clinical system in a sense, and we have other interests of capital equipment and clinical care that's of interest to us. So it's sort of evolving from no service line into, it's not really a service line, but it's sort of a proto-service line. I would just say that in the other performance clinics in urology, cardiology, and orthopedics, we're only beginning to convene the clinicians together and to begin to build some of the elements of connection and communication, which is fairly evident in primary care and eye care. I think I'm going to wrap up here. I'll just show you on the bottom of page 26 and 27, you can see some of the performance. We improved wait time. It's not perfect, both in primary care and eye care. There's a tremendous waiting list for new patients waiting for appointments, and we've reduced that dramatically. My later slides are some of the balancing measures and some of the national data, which I think I'll, in the interest of time, skip and turn this over to Tom, who I think has some additional comments before we open up for more questions.
Thank you. I wanted to just take us back to the bottom of page 5, and in a kind of paradoxical 5 to 10 minutes push at you a few key points when I'm preaching that you should actually create pull versus push. I think this notion of creating pull, I mean, one of the things, Jim, that'd be fun to take up on the web is this notion of the eye care impetus, you said, coming from on high. And, you know, what would happen, what would be the evidence that veterans themselves who'd experienced one experience in a clinic begin to be really more potent demanders of a different way of an adjacent clinic operating? You know, what are the ways in which one really starts to feel a tipping point where there really starts to be some movement through the social ground to do things a different way? And I think often customers are a major source of pull. Just at the bottom of page 5, I think one is this sort of notion of a moral idea. Sometimes we, you know, as professionals, we think the rational and the logic is so overwhelming, we don't take the time to think of it in a key phrase that has a motivating pull to it that really hooks something inside the person whose behavior we're trying to influence. Convenience, risk profile control, these are things that I think Vandeven covered very nicely, and I'll skip over those. If we move to the top of page 6, just some tactics for creating pull. One is this notion of natural entry points. I mean, one of the simplest things we've done, we were with a very large national organization, healthcare organization, probably 60, 70 different sites around the country. And it was one of these special strategy events. And we simply had them list already scheduled on the calendar meetings that different people were going to be in, the CFOs, the CMOs, the CEOs, the something, the quality council, et cetera. And instead of having a separate process for the follow-through to this strategic conference, the idea was to infiltrate and use already existing infrastructure. So this sort of notion of really looking at meetings that already happen that are kind of flat, that aren't used very well. In Jim's case, you know, having to create the team meetings in order to get that local synergy is sort of an added burden. So if you're thinking of a phasing strategy, you might deliberately say, let's start with clinics that already have a pretty decent local team culture, because we know that's going to tip them to be able to see results faster and give us more cases that we can then use as social proof that this is the better way to move. One of the things that's really changed in our thinking from early work that CIFAR had done in stakeholder theory is we often thought it was important to sort of identify opponents early on and, you know, try to engage with them, et cetera. And I think if you look at political organizing, the people who went with Jimmy Carter to New Hampshire, it's a small, inside, passionate group, and we often move too quickly to open it up. And I think many times we're more effective in spread if we sort of like water flow around some of the resistance and leave behind pockets of the past and really try to make something critical happen, and then with that as a power base take on the parts of the system that continue to substantially underperform a new emerging standard of what's possible with the existing resources. This notion of a stealth phase came to us in looking at fundraising campaigns. No fundraiser would ever announce a campaign until they have maybe 40 to 60% of the dollars already raised, and then they go public with it. And yet, the VA particularly, in cases I'm aware of, will announce something very big, often before they have the infrastructure, before they have the preliminary results. And so we would really counsel people to think explicitly of a kind of stealth phase where you're almost attracting people who are curious what's going on as opposed to a huge outward-bound communications task. And then once you've really got something going, facts on the ground, which I think are most important today because people are so cynical about leader talk, they want to see it, touch it, taste it in some way. This sort of notion of empower, educate, authorize people with the highest stakes. You know, there's stories of web resources that were created for physicians in the latest findings about cancer and the advanced clinical trials, and they couldn't get physicians' attention until they actually opened it up to patients so that the patient actually carries the pull from to the boundary with the physician. This notion that I talked about before of creating space for the new behaviors, of always starting an intervention by asking, what are we doing now that we could stop doing that would create a little more space? What Vandeven and Don Berwick talk about, the need for slack to sit, to think, to innovate, to do those kinds of things. I've touched on the bottom of six of this notion of spending time really in a thoughtful way to get the phrase. I think the VA goes way too quickly to alphabet soup that means something to the providers but really doesn't mean an awful lot to the other stakeholders in some way. Let me skip over the two slides on page 7. They're just some tips about how one keeps those themes genuinely alive. The bottom of page 8 is another rationalization for why this stealth phase. One of the things we found is that the amount of change and the relationship to resistance is not a 45-degree angle. There's always a period of where you can get quite a lot of change without triggering a lot of flack, and that you really want to milk that period as richly as you can. And then you want to avoid this middle zone where sometimes it goes public, buys a lot of resistance, but it actually doesn't produce a heck of a lot more change. And then you want to wait till you're really at a stage where, if there's going to be a lot of flack, go for the whole change. And that's when you might dramatically restructure. You might, really create the temporary infrastructure for this particular spread, and innovation now becomes the way we normally do business. A couple of other quick points, and then we'll open it up. On page 9, Jim spoke thoughtfully about the care and attention that went into building the infrastructure, and I think that is commendable. This just invites any of us who are trying to make this thing happen to think about the mix of using existing standing machinery versus creating new machinery. And we have just been involved with so many groups that have been created and float inside organizational space like boat people. They aren't sure exactly what their charter is. They don't know quite who they're attached to or whatever. And so you really need to design that infrastructure exactly like you're designing a temporary organization. What's the authority? Where does it fit? Who's connected to it? Are they representative? Are they just thinking as individuals, et cetera. And this just gives you some key points to think about in building what we might call the scaffolding to support a spread effort. At the top of 10, this is amplifies on my point about our theory of sequencing of stakeholders' changes, that in the phase one, which is sort of about direction and momentum, you really want people with passion. You absolutely need to titrate them with friendly skeptics, not opponents, but you know, people who are thoughtful and keep the passionate people from being completely delusional and unconnected to reality, et cetera. And then you know, sometimes a few people who kind of give you cover, but those are often not way high up in the organization. Phase two then has a different set of folks, particularly people at different beachheads. I liked Jim's story about this this social network of liaisons into each of the different sites so that you had a kind of a communications infrastructure that could rapidly get information, again, in two ways, not just from the center push, but to listen to what some problem a local's experiencing that the group needs to solve or some innovation they've produced that can then be shared with other people. And that it's really at the latter stages that the senior leadership often get on board and that you really take on the pockets of resistance. Just to and I'm just going to end on the bottom of page 11, and the other materials just gives you a little bit more about the overall framework. The skills, we believe, are a little bit counterintuitive. You obviously need a mix of both, but we feel the emphasis in a lot of the spread writings and advice has been too much on the one side, that it's much, much, much less telling and selling, and instead it's listening and amplifying and linking and connecting. It's sort of introducing people who are both troubled by the same set of facts, who are both interested in the same set of innovation. It's not pushing people to change. It's trying to create pull for the change. It's not, you know, trying to motivate people, which takes an enormous amount of energy. I loved the comment about it, that before you could take on a compliance culture, you had to kind of wake people up and really start to open up that culture and rebuild the people's sense of potency, that I can make a difference. And it may be that they first need to feel I can make a difference in some smaller realm than the big pilot that you're trying to bring into being. Just a sense of authentically being listened to, that their intelligence about what the patients want, how the world's changing, is valued, harnessed, used, built upon. Instead we need, you know, to, as I say, to release passion and energy. And then really the most powerful one, and I think there's just some terrific stories that Jim has told and others have told in these calls, that this is not a long-range you know, in the ivory tower planning exercise. It's this notion of act your way to new thinking. Get out there and try it, pilot it, test it, and learn from experience. Listen to the customers. And the companies that I think are most effective at sustained innovation have this cultural orientation that Karen Eisenhart calls, a pilot orientation, rapid prototyping, that almost before the idea is fully elaborated, they're looking for a place where it's already happening or where they can try it and really learn from back where I began, frontline practice, where the rubber meets the road is the crucible for whether these ideas are going to have the kind of credibility that's needed for them to deserve to spread. Thank you.
And are we ready for those questions at this point?
I think we are.
Yes. Okay, very good. We're going to do something just a bit different. We're going to ask the audience to give us several different questions, and then the presenters will respond to that information in a group. So if you do have a question for any of our presenters at this time, all you have to do is press 1 on your phone's keypad, and that, again, puts you into the question queue. When your turn comes up, I'll call on you by the city and the first name of the registrant at your location. If by chance your question is answered while you're in line, simply press the pound key, and that will take you back out of the queue. If you are listening on a speakerphone and it's at all possible, please pick up your handset when you ask your question, as we'll be able to hear you much better that way. So again, if you have a question, pressing 1 now will bring you into the queue, and the pound key will take you out of the queue. And at this point, I'm checking, and I don't see any email questions that have come in. If anyone wishes to send a question via that route, you can send that to moda@krm.com. We do have our first question in the queue, and at this point, it's the only one, so I'll let you know after this question is asked if we need to move on to the next question. To San Diego's location, Janet's location in San Diego. Go ahead. The line is open.
Hi, this is Tina Daly from San Diego. We're wondering here in San Diego, from page 5, the lower cell, what is Filofax?
Filofax was just sort of a paper pre-version of Palm Pilot. It's the kind of product that triggers the emotional hook that it could make someone with ADD organized and in control of their schedule.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to San Diego. I do not have any other questions at this time, and this certainly is a good opportunity. We do have about 12 minutes remaining. If you need any clarification or want to get further detail, this would be a good time to do that. Again, pressing 1 brings you into the question queue, and the pound key will take you back out of the queue. Any other information that either our presenters or Marie, if you have anything you'd like to share, and I can let anyone know as soon as I see a question come in.
I could make a comment, Tom, about your passion and awareness, and your comment about veterans sort of stating their case directly. I think in retrospect that was a powerful motivator of veterans presenting the care, saying, I need access, I'm out of medications, or I have an uncontrolled diabetes or something like that, tapping into the provider's clinical sympathy and interest in trying to serve veterans. And that, even though there's a compliance culture and measure and aims from on high, many of our staff were feeling the pressure from the phones and from veterans walking in that the current system was not working. So that helped produce a little additional tension for change for us.
And Jim, how were veterans embedded in the infrastructure you designed? Did they come to the breakthrough meetings? Were they on advisors? Were VSOs, service organizations involved in any ongoing way?
I don't think we involved them in an effective way. Their voice was at the front lines in clinics, but we didn't explicitly include them in our breakthrough series at our collaborative meetings, probably to our detriment. We might have motivated our staff and helped push the effort a little faster if we had included that voice in various places in our spread work.
I mean, something that we've thought about in a number of situations, one of my mentors did some work in underground coal mining where one section of the mine was using an innovative way and the rest wasn't. And you always get this splitting between the innovator, the leading, and the lagging edge. And just take the nursing home example. Sometimes it's useful to, right at the beginning of the piloting phase, to put together a group of observer, learners, lurkers who meet periodically just to come out and walk around the site, listen to some of the emergent problems, et cetera, so that you actually are thinking spread way, way, way upstream at the front end and beginning to have a place for the kind of curious but not ready yet to get up a learning curve so that after the stealth phase, when there's some real facts on the ground, some learnings, the kind of data, Jim, that you've presented, there's a group of people who are already a little bit up to speed.
We do have one additional call at this point from Chevy Chase, Maryland, at Dennis's location. The line is open. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, this is Sam Holtzman again. Mr. Gilmore, on page number 6, I really am sort of fascinated by the concept of creating pull, and you didn't say very much about restraining forces. Could you give me some examples of what you consider to be restraining forces and as you're trying to create pull?
Well, I don't know how many people on the call are familiar with Kurt Lewin's notion of driving forces and restraining forces, and his notion was that if you have a goal, which might be saying giving up smoking or losing weight, and your current state is you're 20% overweight, that a driving force is a force that pushes you in the direction of your goal, and a restraining force is something that pushes against it. So a stressful situation may cause you to eat. A driving force might be the latest bulletin about adult onset diabetes. And one of the findings is that driving forces often create their own opposition, whereas if you reduce a restraining force, so if you help people reduce stress, that there's kind of a natural moving towards their goal versus an offsetting force. So I think one restraining force that in Jim's case, it seems to me like relieving them of the burden of a lot of data collection allows people who good clinicians want to have shorter weights, right? So that if you can take away some of the barriers to their being shorter weights, you know, make the postcard system easy to use, not hard to use, it will naturally get better. Whereas if we push with pronouncements from on high and edicts and arguing with people as if they were resisting, it actually can increase the resistance. Is that helpful?
Yes. Would you consider performance evaluation a restraining force or a driving force?
I think if you can set goals and give people flexibility in how to meet them, that creates pull. So that if I know I have to meet a new standard, I'm going to be motivated to search for better ways to meet that particular goal. If we over-specify it, I think it can become a sense of a restraining force. I think it's a very important judgment call for all of you of how soon do the metrics shift from a kind of learning experiment mode to a performance and consequences for not meeting the new standards. And Jim, I wonder if you have any thoughts on that tipping point. When do you switch from kind of embracing data, even if it doesn't show good results, versus this is the new standard and you've got to comply?
Well, we had a lot of data. One of the initial dynamics was people didn't believe the data. They said that's wrong, and they would fight the data and said, I'm not going to bother with it. And we had to convince people that, well, good, bad, or indifferent, somebody in Washington or somebody in higher up is looking at this data and making judgments about us. So if the data is wrong, let's look at it. And we actually find a substantial amount of scheduling error in the data. And a major initiative was to teach some of our clerks how to schedule accurately so that data would accurately reflect it. But until we did that, that became sort of a stopper because people said, well, I don't believe the data. You know, you say my wait time is long, but I don't believe it, and I know that I can get an appointment next week or, you know, very quickly or something like that. So that was an example of something stopping us, and then we had to address it. And then once we took away that problem of scheduling error, then people, there was validity and curiosity around the next available wait time, and people said, gosh, my wait time is too long. That can't be good for patients. Well, let's see, what could I do to improve it? So that might be how we handled it, an example.
Jim, we do have one additional question and about 4 minutes remaining, so we'll go to what likely will be our last call to Minneapolis at Renee's location. Minneapolis, the line is open.
Thank you. Mr. Gilmore, I am looking at the slide at the top of page 10, and I wonder if you would comment about the role of leaders in this model. Traditionally, when we're managing change, we think that we need the leaders to drive that change, and yet on this slide, I see them located in phase three. So I wondered if you would comment.
Yes, I think the probably to be polemical, we only put it there, but the critical leader role, I think, in phase one is really creating a culture of curiosity and inquiry and looking for the good ideas. But the state of relationships now between leaders and followers, I think, is not in terrific shape. I think there's an enormous amount of skepticism when people look up. There's an enormous amount of sense of I have to sell my leader on particular ideas. And I think where leaders are able to join with ideas that are already present and encourage people through those first couple of phases, they really win legitimacy to bring and champion their issues that they may have brought from a previous job experience or whatever. That really the leader's job often is to link and knit ideas together into larger systems. I think a leader plays an incredibly important role in setting the climate for spread and the kind of openness. I mean, the most famous example probably in corporate settings would be Hewlett Packard and the HP way, where leaders really amplified just the unbelievable amount of creativity that were in the frontline engineers.
Minneapolis, did that take care of the question?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. And at this point, we have about a minute and a half or so remaining, and I know, Marie, you have a few comments that you need to make.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to thank both of our speakers, Tom Gilmore and Jim Schlosser, for really very interesting and provocative, I think, in some ways, some of the ideas to help us really push our thinking forward with some of these concepts around spread. So I want to thank you both, and thank you for introducing us to some innovative ways of carrying on this conversation with our listeners. So I would like to remind everyone to complete the CMEs, so follow the instructions on your material. And also, we've had a number of sort of times during the call today where we've talked about how it would be helpful to possibly to carry on this conversation on our on the website, on the qualityhealthcare.org discussion group. And so we want to continue to encourage people to go there and to post your questions, and faculty and other members of the community that we're building here around spread hopefully will respond and we'll get some discussion moving. There is a question that was posed there following last week's call around how you track and measure the actual improvements throughout an organization. So hopefully we'll get some discussion moving on that one, too. So once again, thanks, everybody.
Marie?
Yes?
I just wanted the caller from San Diego, we did not address the question of no-show rate.
Mm-hmm.
And either that could be handled on the web discussion, which would be great.
Right.
Or if that individual wanted to contact me directly, if through you, I would be glad to follow up that way also to make sure that that question gets answered.
Okay, that's terrific. Thanks, Jim.
Okay, that concludes today's program, Communication and the Social System, brought to you by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, presented by Thomas Gilmore and Dr. James Schlosser, and moderated by Marie Schall. Reminder to please fill out your evaluation form. Your comments and suggestions help us provide you with future quality programming. Today's program is copyright 2003 by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, all rights reserved. Thank you for joining us for this program, and enjoy the rest of your day. You may disconnect now.